don't even have to say anything sometimes at the door.
Knock on the door.
We've been waiting for you.
That happens almost every time.
The Recall Lindsay Holmes Group gathers signatures door to door from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 4th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Alaska Volcano Observatory keeps tabs on another round of the Pavlov eruption.
We retrospectively looked at the seismicity and we said, oh, yep, there it is. It's really subtle, but there it is.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Lindsay Holmes, who serves Anchorage District 19 in the State House of Representatives, switched parties just after she was elected last year. A group led by Anchorage resident Colleen Murphy, hoping to recall her, is getting ready to submit their application to the Division of Elections. KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports.
Hi, I'm Ouija from the Recall Lindsay Holmes Group, and we're going door-to-door asking our neighbors if they'd be interested in signing our recall petition. Are you interested? Okay.
It's after 5 o'clock in the Turnigan neighborhood in West Anchorage, and Ouija Tazi is having no trouble collecting recall signatures for the campaign to recall Lindsay Holmes. Holmes, a Republican member of the Alaska House representing an area that spans South and West Anchorage, was running as a Democrat when voters cast their ballots back in November. Just before the legislature was getting ready to convene in January, she switched parties. That ticks John Miller off.
We voted for her because we favor the Democrat philosophy. She switched to Republican. She got bought off by the Republican Party. I think she's lost all her credibility.
Miller has already signed the petition. His wife, Joanne, signs tonight. Miller says what really bothers him is Holmes' dramatic departure from her Democratic campaign issues.
First of all, as soon as she became a Republican, obviously there was a deal in the works for some weeks before she switched, probably well before the election. She gets some plum assignment on a committee and starts voting the Republican line on SB 21, every pro-business, pro-oil bill. And I spoke to her before the election, and she was not in favor of any of that when she spoke to me.
Tazi, along with a small group of volunteers, has collected nearly 1,000 signatures, more than they need to submit their initial application to the Division of Elections. The grassroots effort is organized out of a spacious ranch-style home in West Anchorage.
Welcome to the home of the Recall Lindsay Holmes campaign. It's my personal residence, and we started meeting on January 31st.
Murphy's kitchen countertops are covered with stacks of paper. In a corner sits the signature gathering sheets.
Right there, sitting by the window. That's a lot of people that are concerned about what has happened to the voting process in District 19.
Murphy says Holmes is not fit for duty because she deceived the voters when she filled out her State of Alaska Declaration of Candidacy, indicating she was running as a Democrat and would serve as a Democrat.
The bottom line is it really boils down to where you go in as a declaration of candidate. It really defies logic that someone would switch parties in that period before they assumed their position.
Tazi and Murphy have big Recall Lindsay Holmes stickers on the backs of their signature collecting clipboards, which they say makes gathering signatures easy.
And people say, oh, we don't even have to say anything sometimes at the door.
Knock on the door.
We've been waiting for you.
Yep.
We've been waiting for you.
That happens almost every time. You knock on a door, or you go to walk up and knock on the door, and the door opens, and they say, we're so glad you're here.
Yeah.
Holmes is keeping an eye on the recall effort, but she doesn't seem particularly worried about it.
It's their job to prove whether or not the rationale is sufficient. But honestly, I don't think it is. I think that in our state, you can't recall somebody unless you have particular specific legal grounds. And I don't think that changing your party affiliation qualifies.
Holmes says her decision to change parties was the culmination of a shift she'd been feeling for a few years.
I had felt myself aligning more and more on economic development and business issues with the majority, the Republican-led majority. And I had felt myself distancing myself more and more from the stances of some of my Democratic colleagues. I had just felt that on the economic development and business issues, which I thought were important, if we want to fund schools and roads and police, we need money to do it.
Holmes says she brought in millions for her district as a Republican that she could not have secured had she stayed in the minority. The Recall Lindsey Holmes campaign plans to submit the first round of signatures required for the recall application to the Division of Elections by the end of June. If their application is approved, they'll be required to collect 2,000 more signatures. If they're successful, the state would hold a special election for voters in her district to decide on the recall. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Interest rates for future subsidized Stafford loans will double July 1st if Congress fails to craft a solution. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, there are competing bills, all very similar, but politics is getting in the way, and incoming college freshmen in Alaska are left in the gray.
There's a bit of truth squatting that needs to take place first, and we'll let Beth Akers take care of that.
The political discussions surrounding this suggest that these are students who are already in repayment who are going to see higher payments due for their loans starting in August, and that's just not the case. It's new students who are taking out loans and who are in school now and will start repayment after they graduate.
Akers is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Unsubsidized Stafford loans are available to all students. The debate is over the federally subsidized ones that go disproportionately to low-income students. The government pays the interest on the loan while a student is enrolled in school. The current interest rate is 3.4%, and it's slated to double in just 4 weeks. Congress has the authority over the interest rate, and it's prepared to do something huge: seed power. The House passed a bill 2 weeks ago that ties the interest rate to the 10-year Treasury note.
The interest rate will fluctuate over the course of the loan, just like a variable rate mortgage would.
The plan would cap any interest rate at 8.5%. The House passed it along mostly partisan lines. Congressman Don Young skipped the vote. It's not wholly different from President Barack Obama's plan. But speaking at the White House Friday morning, he objected to the idea that rates could change year to year with the 10-year T-note.
That's not smart. It eliminates safeguards for lower-income families. That's not fair. It could actually cost a freshman starting school this fall more over the next 4 years than if we did nothing at all.
The president said he wants students to permanently lock in one rate for the lifetime of the loan. The Senate is preparing to vote on its package this week. Senator Mark Begich supports an idea floated by Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. That plan would keep rates at 0.75% for 1 year, the rate banks borrow money at.
Why would we loan money to banks and then stick it to our students?
Akers from the Brookings Institution dismisses the idea as politics, but there are substantive reasons she thinks the rates should be higher than 0.75%.
When you set interest rates really low, you're essentially making the financing of education really cheap, which is going to have the effect of driving up tuition prices, but it also has the effect that students become less wary about this financial decision they're making.
If this sounds vaguely familiar, it's because Congress had this very fight last year, right in the middle of the presidential campaign, and nobody wanted to be labeled as voting to increase student loan rates. Instead of fixing the problem, Congress delayed the increase a year, and now we're 4 weeks away from the delayed deadline. Senator Lisa Murkowski would not commit to any package, the president's or the House version, and she does not seem optimistic for any legislative action. It's possible Congress once again delays the increase without fixing the problem.
You know, is a one-year fix a good deal? No, it's not a good deal. But is it maybe what we're left with? Maybe.
Some of the uncertainty could begin to vanish later this week when the Senate takes an initial vote. Education advocates are encouraging students to submit their FAFSA applications for aid, regardless of the political fight. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Last week, a Superior Court judge scolded the state's redistricting board, saying that it was holding up the redrawing of the state's political boundaries. Now, some Democratic lawmakers are calling for nonpartisan masters to step in and guide the redistricting process. The five-person redistricting board is made up of political appointees, and Republican leaders got to choose four of those seats this cycle. Senator Hollis French, an Anchorage Democrat, says that a politicized process has resulted in delays.
I guess we wanted to give the board the opportunity to do the right thing, but they've refused so many times now that it seems unlikely that they're going to do the right thing in the future. And so now it's time to get a master appointed, get neutral lines drawn that comply with the Alaska State Constitution, and let the next election go forward under a plan that's constitutional.
French says there's precedent for getting independent experts involved. The courts have appointed masters to steer the redistricting process in the 1970s and again in the 1990s. But French sees this as just a short-term fix. In the past, he's put forward legislation to create a nonpartisan redistricting board, and he's considering doing that again next session. Bob Brody serves on the redistricting board, and he doesn't think an intervention is necessary. Brody says the board will meet this Friday to address the Superior Court's criticisms.
The judge seemed to think that we need to get on a faster track, and we're prepared to do that. We're just going to have to see how it works with everybody's schedule.
In addition to working at an accelerated pace, Brody says that the board is open to having public meetings after they release their map. That's another concern of the Superior Court. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Petersburg works on solutions to a problem with sea lions in the harbor.
We've just been having so many reports of near close calls so far this spring that we just had to take drastic measures.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or a transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
After a week-long respite, Pavlov Volcano on the Alaska Peninsula has sent up another ash plume. Pilots flying past the volcano this morning were the first to spot the cloud, which they estimate at 19,000 feet. Pennair Flight Operations Manager Lloyd Siebert says the airline canceled its afternoon flight into Sandpoint as a result, but the plume hasn't affected any other Pennair routes. Alaska Volcano Observatory geologist Michelle Coombs says this pattern of fluctuating activity is pretty standard for Pavlov, but that it can make monitoring difficult.
In this case, actually, we had a pilot report that came in, and we retrospectively looked at the seismicity, and we said, oh, yep, there it is. It's really subtle, but there it is. So we'll just do our best and keep our eye on things. But, yeah, it's a bit of a tricky volcano.
Coombs says the reason for that is once the volcano has been erupting for a while, the magma isn't creating new routes to the surface.
It's basically, you know, more of an open pathway, and so the magma can come up without making a lot of seismic rumbling.
Nevertheless, Coombs says the observatory would be able to detect a significant intensification of the eruption. They've raised the aviation alert level to orange. Petersburg's officials and enforcement officers are cracking down on a growing problem in the borough's harbor, sea lions. More and more of the creatures have arrived in the harbor, lured by the catch of local sport and commercial fishing fleets. As KFSK's Robbie Feinberg reports, the problem has turned dangerous.
If you head out to Petersburg Harbor on a typical day, you're bound to see fishermen gutting their catch at the harbor's cleaning stations and throwing heads, bones, and scraps into the water. But you'll also see sea lions searching for those remains to eat. Glo Wallen is the Petersburg harbor master. She points in the direction of a sign that says in big red letters, "Do not feed or harass sea lions."
Areas that we had a fish cleaning station that was used and, people would put their what they thought was responsible to put it down the chute. But you know, if the sea lion is eating it, that means you're feeding it. So, you know, in the eyes of the law.
Those types of signs have become necessary in the harbor. Sea lions have started to overtake the area, hanging around near the docks to snag remains of a gutted fish. Recently, the problem has swelled. Wallen says that what started off as 6 sea lions a year ago has grown into 20 this year. And those animals have been getting more and more aggressive towards humans.
We've just been having so many reports of near close calls here so far this spring that we just had to take drastic measures.
Feeding the sea lions isn't just dangerous. It's illegal. Jared Cook is with the National Marine Fisheries Service. He says that according to the Marine Mammal Protection Act, feeding sea lions in the wild is technically harassment, and it can carry fines of $200 to $500. After receiving more reports of sea lion attacks recently, Cook is worried.
People have reported being charged by them, and where the sea lion comes up and doesn't necessarily jump completely up on the dock, but hits the dock with his chest and jumps up, and very aggressive. And it's very intimidating for folks, and the concern is that somebody's going to get seriously hurt.
The animals have even attacked harbor users in the past. Cook wants to fix the problem before it gets any worse, but his plan isn't to sit at the dock and issue more tickets. Instead, he wants to work with the borough and the harbor to find a proactive solution to the problem. Cook took the first step in that process on Monday when he brought up the issue at Petersburg's assembly meeting. The members were receptive to fixing the problem, but they couldn't agree on a solution just yet. One idea that the assembly floated was to follow in the footsteps of larger harbors like Sitka. In these harbors, the city added a large catch basin, a central spot to deposit fish carcasses that could then be tossed out farther out in the ocean or delivered to a cannery. But Wallen says that would require resources that she simply doesn't have.
Right now, I don't have a staff that's big enough to essentially, you know, sit and wait for a carcass to come in to transfer it.
Another potential solution was to have fishermen simply clean and fillet their fish on the water. But Doug Fleming with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game pointed out that people need to comply with state rules.
Regulations for fish like king salmon or with halibut, we need to have fish brought in so they can be measured.
And Mayor Mark Jensen added that even if the borough does find a short-term solution, like closing down a few cleaning stations, enforcing the sea lion rules won't be easy.
You know, talk about the signage that we've had in the harbor that Officer Cook has provided. You know, it's just against the law, you'll get a fine. And just last week, my son and I are taking one of our skiff out of the water, and he's waiting for me to back the trailer down, and somebody down unloading, and I don't know who it was, dressing a fish at the end of the pier at the loading ramp was complaining about the sea lions, and on the other hand, they're throwing their guts up in the air to see if they can make the sea lion jump out of the water and catch it. So do you give shock collars to all the people that go out if they don't obey the rules or something? I mean, how do you do it? You have someone sitting there the whole time. It is very complicated, an issue. And
ultimately, the assembly wanted input from Petersburg's Harbor Advisory Board, and the topic will be on that group's agenda later this month. Wallen has already removed a few of the fish cleaning stations from the harbor, and she's alerted fishermen too, letting them know that they need to be responsible for their own catch. But the hope is that the harbor board, city, and the fishermen can work together to find a better solution in the coming weeks and months. In Petersburg, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Northern Air Cargo, since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com.
The National Park Service is finalizing its strategy for future land acquisitions in and around Lake Clark National Park. The park's first final land protection plan should be finished in July. KDLG's Ben Matheson has the details.
Like most land status maps in Alaska, national park maps are messy, showing the dozens of colors representing different owners. Lake Clark National Park is now in the process of organizing its land ownership data and laying out a plan for possible future acquisitions. John Quinley is a spokesperson for the National Park Service.
When these parks were established in 1980, they encompassed a fair amount of non-federal land. Some is owned by the state of Alaska. Other parcels are owned by Alaska Native corporations and village corporations. And then other typically smaller pieces are owned by individuals, either native allotments, homesteads, or other forms of private property inside the park.
The top priority sites are dozens of small tracts clustered along the shore of Lake Clark. Most are quite small, under 100 acres, but collectively they cover a substantial portion of the shoreline. The park says this raises concerns about protection of park resources and public access to the lake. The 30-page plan catalogs hundreds of sites that could be acquired, but Quinley says right now there's no money set aside for buying land.
Frequently we have more inholders, private property owners, offering lands for sale than we have funding for. And these plans help us decide which ones to negotiate with the owners on first.
Quinley says the Park Service tends to prioritize funding what are called hardship cases.
Frequently, these are native allotments, often small number of acres, and a family, this may be property that they acquired many years ago, perhaps no longer really make use of, and they are offering it for sale to the federal government. Frequently, they're a hardship case where the family needs to use the money for something else. And that typically moves towards the top of the line for us in terms of finding money nationally.
The plan is required to consider lands adjacent to the park. West and south of the park is the site of the proposed pebble mine. Future plans could involve the construction of a road connecting the site to Cook Inlet. The document does not take a position on the project, but it notes that the disruption of salmon streams and new infrastructure associated with mining could result in major impacts to park resources and values. Quinley says the plan addresses the prospect broadly, but it will not spell out the park's official policy.
I don't think we're going to take any kind of position on Pebble for some time until we see more specifically what those companies have in mind in terms of exact locations and the activities that they're looking at as they do their planning.
The Park Service is also making a land protection plan for Gates of the Arctic National Park. Public comments are accepted through July 10th at parkplanning.nps.gov. In Dillingham, I'm Ben Matheson.
Sitka weaver Terry Rothkar has been named the 2013 Rasmussen Distinguished Artist. The annual award is given by the Rasmussen Foundation to an Alaska artist with a history of accomplishment. It brings with it a $40,000 prize. KCAW's Ed Ronco talked to Rothkar at her Sitka studio.
Up a staircase, through a bedroom, and there it is. A room lit by skylights and tall windows. The studio where Terry Rothkar weaves her work.
Ground zero for creativity.
It is in the studio that Rothkar has shelves of books on subjects ranging from Russians in Alaska to Tlingit ethnobotany. Bins on a low shelf hold wool.
Mountain goat, merino, alpaca, and bison, because I did use the buffalo wool for that robe for the Park Service. And then dog. I'm working on a dog robe.
There's a spinning wheel in the middle of the room and a weaving frame on which hangs the beginnings of her next project. And over on one of the shelves, right next to an elegant blue vase, is a small frame holding the picture of a shirtless, chiseled man.
Oh, he's just purely inspiration.
Did he come with a frame?
No, I put him in that frame. I've probably had him for 30 years, and he's still inspiring. Yeah, I think that's the one thing that I've actually had to frisk out of gal's hands. I'm like, you put that right back.
Of course, Rothkar's real inspirations for her work come from all around her. Maybe it's a story told by a family member, or the 1964 Alaska earthquake. She calls herself a basket weaver, but much of her work is traditional Tlingit raven's tail robes. Baskets, she says. Big baskets that hold people. Rothkar has been weaving for years. Her work is often surprising, incorporating an unusual color or a new feature, like DNA symbols woven into a recent robe that she did about goats. She says finding new ways to appreciate the art is important.
That's where the rubber meets the road. Are you still doing it? Does it still inspire you? Are you still excited to get in there and do the dirty work? Absolutely. You know,
why?
There's so many more discoveries, you know. It's like the ocean that we haven't explored. It's all of those worms.
I remember interviewing you a few years back for a robe you were working on for the National Park. Mm-hmm. And what I remember about that interview is you opened a drawer that the robe was sitting in before it was unveiled, and you spoke to the robe.
Yes.
I hear a lot of personification in the way you talk about your art.
Oh, well, it embodies the place, right? It's a reflection of... Maybe it was a reflection in that case, a reflection of that history of the park and that place of the park. But, oh, this robe over here that's about the mountain goat on Baranoff Island has the double helix DNA stranding. The science that I've embedded in it, the double helix, is accurate. So there are the two populations on each side of the robe. I guess... They are an entity, just as the materials that I harvest, the tree people and, you know, the ferns and the place that we're at. You know, we live here, but there's others that have been living here for many more thousands of years than us. So, yeah, I think we're just, it's relationships.
Rafkar received her award from the Rasmussen Foundation at an event in Anchorage. She says the money will help her take some time to focus on art for the sake of art, rather than worrying about weaving things that will earn money.
Rasmussen has such a leap of faith to support all these artists, and they're calling it a vision. But for us, it's our journey. You know, they're making our journey possible.
Not a lot of people do what Rafkar does, but she's working to share her art form. She's demonstrated and taught all over the country. And when she started, she says she felt like what she was doing was on the verge of going away.
It seemed like such a fragile art form. There's very few baskets. I think the Tlingit basketry was declared lost in the 50s. So I felt like I was, you know, just single-handedly helping hold it up. And the robes, there's so few of them. And there's getting to be more. But again, here I was, you know, really feeling so much like the carrier of the culture. And I realize now, whoops, this basketry, the weaving, it's been going on for thousands and thousands of years. I'm the one that's fragile. The art will continue on.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Robbie Feinberg in Petersburg, Ben Matheson in Dillingham, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.